Welcome to 2022, everyone. This is the January edition of ASAP Nowcast. In your mailboxes, though, you'll find several interesting items, one of which are some reflections on Afghanistan from the ASAP Government Services chapter. It's a great photo essay, and I hope you'll all enjoy it. Additionally, a recap from 2021 from all of the chapters as to some of their biggest accomplishments in the past year. And you'll find some forensics facts about firearm injuries and how to best describe them in your medical documentation. So I hope you enjoy the magazine when it gets to your mailboxes. But until then, I want us to take a listen to two items that are fairly similar. One is about a case of a patient with opioid use disorder, and the other one is about what we can do as physicians to help treat this chronic condition. Thank you everyone for joining me today. Our podcast is going to be two parts about opiate use disorder. Our first guest is going to be Dr. Adam Lally. He's an emergency medicine resident at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York, and wrote a really intriguing piece called The Essay as a Literary Model for the Trials at EM. Dr. Lally, thanks for joining us. You described a scene at the end of your intern year. I'm going to quote from the piece. You spoke with the mother of a 24-year-old man who had been brought in unresponsive to our resuscitation bay. He was trying, his mother told me. Hearing her own words out loud, she was struggling to believe what happened. He had just finished rehab and promised he would stop, she explained. So you describe the essay as this late form of literary means, unlike a poem or play which had been around previously, and it's something which focuses on things like improvisation. You describe it like emergency medicine itself. The essay is like a form of emergency medicine. So can you explain that to the listeners of ASAP Now?
Yeah, so I was an English major in college, so I know learned a little bit about the history of literary forms. And you start out reading poems, which is one of the oldest forms of literature. And I think when people think of classic poems, they think of the sonnet, which is a highly dense, determined, structured work. You have rhymes, you have a certain number of stressed syllables per line. Some people might remember it's A, B, A, B. You know, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G. And it takes a lot of thought. And when it comes out, it's this kind of perfect, you know, shaped work of literature, which is definitely not what emergency medicine feels like to me. To me, you know, emergency medicine is a lot less structured. You often are dealing with imperfect situations. And I thought that if emergency medicine were to be a form of literature, it would probably be more like an essay than it would be like a poem. Some of the best essayists of all time, you know, recently passed Joan Didion and Virginia Woolf, when you read their essays, they don't always start out with a clear sense of where they're going to go. You're following them along for the ride, and there are surprises and there are turns. And as you are reading an essay, you're finding out who the essayist is, and you're slowly coming to increasing clarity about what you're really talking about, which to me feels like a typical day in the emergency department.
Tell me a little bit about this story. Well, I guess it's not really a story. It's a person's life that came in. This is while you were an intern, and there was a patient came in, opiate use disorder, and I guess they had overdosed. Tell us about that.
The first thing that happened was the patient coming in, and it was one of these situations where EMS is wheeling them in really quickly, doing compressions while they're wheeling the patient in. They immediately went from the entrance to the hospital right into our resuscitation bay, and the patient looked very, very sick, and potentially, just looking at him, he looked as though he had already died. His skin was darkened and blue, he wasn't breathing, and we immediately started chest compressions. We started doing all the things that you do in the resuscitation bay, getting access, getting vitals, and we, despite our best efforts, we weren't able to resuscitate him. We didn't get a heartbeat. And then the next thing that happened was the family, the whole family, the mother, the father, brother, who had probably been following the ambulance in their own car, but wasn't able to go through red lights, probably got a little bit of traffic. They came next. And while we were working on the patient, they were standing outside. And there's a moment when I just left the resuscitation bay and decided to talk to the family while we were still doing compressions, just to update them. And it was just, looking at the family, it was just pure anguish. They didn't really know what was going on. They weren't sure if we would be able to resuscitate him or not. And immediately the mother started telling me the story of how she had found him in his bedroom about 20 minutes after he had said goodnight to her. And then the story started coming out about a young man who had been struggling, likely for years, with an opioid addiction, had been in rehab, had really put the effort into trying to quit. And like a lot of people who are struggling with this really powerful force of addiction, it looked like he had relapsed. And the mother told me that she had used naloxone, which to me always tells a whole story in itself of what it must have been like for a parent to first be taught about naloxone and to have to, you know, potentially rehearse using it. When a parent has naloxone, it tells me that this has already been going on for a long time, that this is maybe a situation that they had already imagined, hoped would never happen, but still had to prepare for.
Right. It's not just something out of the blue. This is a condition that's been going on with this particular patient for a while, to the point that they have rescue medications available.
So we had been trying to resuscitate the patient for about 25 minutes and without any success. And so given that amount of time without any return of circulation, and given the story of him potentially having been down for 20 minutes plus a 10-15 minute ambulance ride, it was really unlikely that he was going to survive, which I told the parents. And it was a different kind of death, because we have deaths by accident all the time. People who die from car accidents, from sudden injuries that are completely unexpected. And then we also have frequently see deaths of older individuals who've been chronically ill for a long time. This was a death of a young man who had been trying to avoid this for a long time, and in which the family was also engaged in trying to prevent this for a long time. And so it had a special kind of anguish that felt different to me. And it had a whole story of effort behind it, effort of the patient himself, an effort of the family to both be dealing with a young man with serious addiction and also to be putting in the effort to get the training, to learn how to use the naloxone and keep it on hand in this kind of eventuality. So that was the backstory. And as I talked to the mother a little more, everyone's grief takes a different form. And this was a really intelligent woman who really had thought deeply about it, naloxone, how it works, opioid overdose, and how that can lead to fatalities. And she had started asking me a lot of questions. As a intern, I wasn't sure I could give her clear answers for, and I'm not even sure anybody had answers for them. And there were really detailed questions like, what if I had seen him 5 minutes earlier? What if I had seen him 10 minutes earlier? And she was asking about the pathophysiology of naloxone and opioid use, but I felt that it came from a place of grief. Is it my fault for not seeing him sooner? Could I have saved his life if I had done something differently? Which felt very similar to how I felt as an intern. I think how a lot of us feel when we have patients who die. We ask ourselves as doctors, could we have done something differently? And again, there's a whole story of effort behind that. So the patient, the family, me, everyone else involved, there was just so much effort going into this. And it reminded me of this phrase, essayons, which is a French word, which means let's try. One of my professors at medical school, he used to have this on his office, this big word, let's try. And it reminded me of the essay and this literary history of the essay. As I mentioned in the piece, essayons is also the motto of the United States Corps of Engineers. And so I wrote about the intersection of that, of those two things, about this medical story and this literary story.
I think that's the thing that I took out of this piece, and I think that's something that all of our ASAP Nowcast listeners can take out of it. You wrote this, that failure lurks around every corner, and when resignation would be easier, trying can be the greatest act of courage. Failing to resuscitate a patient certainly can seem like that at times, and I think you described that very well in your piece and just now recalling that story.
When you're doing CPR, especially the chest compressions, there's so much physical effort that goes into trying to push this person's heart back into life. And when you're not able to resuscitate someone, when you essentially fail to bring them back to life, there's this emotional fatigue, and it's coupled with this physical fatigue of having just done compressions. You're sometimes even out of breath.
Very true. Later on in today's podcast, we're going to discuss the X waiver, other ways that we as physicians can treat people with the opioid use disorder. I just wanted to ask you, do you have an X waiver? And what's your process for treating folks with addictions?
I don't. We have Ruben Strayer as a faculty member at Maimonides, and he has been helping us to streamline the process of getting X waivers. I hope to get one soon. There have been a couple opportunities for me to fit it into my schedule. My shift schedule has never quite lined up with getting an X waiver, but they are available through our program. Yeah.
I wanted to thank you very much, number one, for writing the article that you did for ASAP Now and for joining me today on ASAP Nowcast. Hope to hear a little bit more about what you're doing as your residency is almost over, right? You have another year or two?
Halfway through.
All right. Best of luck with that, and thanks for joining me today. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever billed for smoking cessation in the ED? You can if you use CPT code 99406 and document the time spent. It's got to be greater than 3 minutes. You can provide services to people that include specific, validated interventions of assessing the patient's readiness for change, identifying barriers, suggesting specific actions, motivational counseling, and arranging follow-up, all in just about 3 or 4 minutes. Make sure to attach an ICD-10 diagnosis code that supports the service, like tobacco counseling or nicotine dependence. In return, you'll get 0.24 work RVUs from many insurance payers. We see patients at pivotal moments in their lives and have the opportunity to change their behavior for the better. Want to learn more? Search ASAP Now for smoking cessation to find the coding wizard for this service. And now, back to the program. Welcome back, everybody. I'm with Dr. Alicia Gonzalez. She's the Regional Director and Clinical Training Lead for the California Bridge Program and the Medical Director of Emergency Medicine at Marion Regional Medical Center in Santa Maria, California. Dr. Gonzalez, thanks for joining us. We're going to talk a little bit about an article that you co-wrote in the January issue of ASAP Now and start out with a pretty startling statistic. People in the United States more likely to die from accidental opioid overdose than motor vehicle crashes. Tell me about that.
Yeah, very true story. We don't realize it, I think, because we just see such a high volume of car accidents and we're so focused on things like trauma. ATLS is a part of all of our training and it's bred into what we do, but we don't spend that much time in our training and our research or when we talk about our workflow in the hospital thinking about substance use. But it is true that when you look at the number of people that die from opiate overdose, it is way up there. Some years it's like number two, number three, number one in certain age groups. It's one of the number one killers of Americans.
Is it really a national problem or is it more of a regional problem? Is the question that I want to ask you about. When I worked in Baltimore. That was my first job out of residency. We saw a ton of heroin use overdoses to the point where sometimes the nurses were so good, they could pluck somebody blue from a car, give Narcan, and then go get the doctor after that. Whereas I think where I work now in Texas, it's not that common an issue for us overall when we're talking about our drugs of abuse. I was looking up some information. Kaiser Family Foundation, which I find is always a great source of unbiased information out there on anything health-related. They looked at overdose deaths related to opioids, and according to them, it varies. Some places, like Connecticut, one of the states with the highest numbers, greater than 90% of their overdose deaths are from opioids, whereas in Hawaii, it's fewer than one quarter. So back to the question, is this a national problem or a regional problem?
The right answer to this is two things. Number one, it's regional. Yes, it's totally regional. However, it is becoming increasingly more and more universal. If you were to go backwards 10 years, you are completely right. Baltimore or San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York City, there were certain hot spots, if you will, areas where we see way more frequent patients coming to the ED or with police on the scene, ambulance on the scene from opioid overdoses. These days, though, it only is becoming more and more pervasive. So you've got places that never used to have significant issues with opioids that do now. In my community here in Santa Maria on the central coast of California, we're not a very urban place, okay? It's like a lot of agriculture and coastline. It's honestly beautiful. You should come visit. But opioids are not something people here are used to talking about in this way because we aren't San Francisco. We aren't LA. We aren't Baltimore. But every single year, we have an increasing number of patients coming in after an overdose, whether it's on purpose or not on purpose, and we can talk about that too. But I do think it's becoming more and more universal. So even though, yes, we're seeing it regionally pocketed, those regions, the number of regions affected is increasing, and it's soon going to be all of us.
You talk about a three-pronged plan, the California Bridge model. Tell me a little bit about California Bridge program and what it means.
The California Bridge Program is an organization that was started underneath the Public Health Institute. It's funded by the Department of Healthcare Services here in California, DHCS. And it was initially just meant to put some funding in to help hospitals catch up with the evidence for treating patients with medication for addiction treatment or medication-assisted treatment when they use opioids is pretty convincing. It just didn't really make it into the mainstream. These are not new drugs. Buprenorphine's been there. If you dust off your like med school cobwebs, I learned about it in med school, but not in a way that I thought people used it. I thought it was something that addiction doctors used. And so it was to take that evidence we have and make it more accessible to everybody. So the way that the Bridge program did that was different hospitals got grants initially, and we did a lot of technical assistance, education, teaching their doctors, helping people get their X waiver. And the approach we take does have three prongs. The first one is medication first, not having a bunch of barriers, having to really assess the patient to make sure you think they're emotionally ready or all of these different barriers, drug testing, getting rid of all of that and putting the medication first, similar to pain. If patients come to the hospital in pain, they don't want you to do 15 labs and a CT scan. They want medicine. They want to feel better. Patients who come to the ER in withdrawal are not interested in going through a long counseling session and a bunch of drug tests before they get medication to stop their withdrawal. That's our push, is medication first, treat the patient in front of you. And there's a lot of data out there that supports the safety in doing that. So medication first. And then the other thing is building a bridge to ongoing care. The emergency department in so many ways, right? We're the fail safe. We're the go-to item for everyone. I don't think any of us want to be that all the time. And I'm not advocating that we should be an ongoing source of drug, you know, treatment for patients, but we are the front door, just like every other part of the healthcare system. So the big piece of that is, can you connect a patient to ongoing care and not just a giant packet of 14 photocopied pages that are grainy and no one's checked their phone number since 1992? That's not a handoff, right? So having an actual connection, a clinic, a list of options, and a way to get a hold of a human being to get that person into ongoing treatment that's not the emergency department. The final piece being the culture around all of this, a culture of harm reduction, decreasing stigma, understanding that substance use disorder is a neurophysiological process. It's a medical disease, a treatable chronic condition that requires medication and ongoing support.
So we talk about first providing low barrier medication-assisted therapy for people with opioid use disorder, typically in active withdrawal in the ER. I read the article. Everybody that's listening to this gets a chance to read the articles because it's helpful to me. It's not something that I usually use, but you describe a pretty simple pathway. So if they're in moderate opioid withdrawal, start with 8 milligrams sublingual or buccal buprenorphine, allow it to dissolve, wait an hour, which we'll probably be doing because we're going to see a couple other patients. Then we come back, we check on the patient, are they feeling better? If so, repeat every hour until withdrawal symptoms have resolved. Or if they're already resolved, give it an additional 8 milligrams to complete the loading dose. Then, after you do that, then this is where you need the X waiver. If you're going to continue treatment, it's 8 milligrams buprenorphine twice daily until they get seen by an outpatient clinician. And that you need the waiver for, essentially.
Right. Essentially. Exactly. And these doses that you're saying are absolutely standard. They work the majority of the time. I will throw out a caveat that if the patient uses high doses of fentanyl, they may require higher doses of buprenorphine. And that just has to do with their body's tolerance, their physical dependence on that drug. But yes, 8 milligrams, wait an hour, give another 8. I'll be honest, once you're pretty good at it and comfortable, it doesn't become a multi-hour thing. You do the 8 milligrams, an hour goes by, you check again. And if they're still in a little withdrawal, you'll start going to 16. It's very safe to do, but these are things that you'll develop over time. And then yeah, going home, 8 milligrams twice a day. Sometimes patients who are fentanyl users though, will have to go higher, 16 milligrams twice a day. And being on a total dose of 32 to 64 per day is safe in those patients because of that increased tolerance. So just things to keep in mind. And we're coming out with a fentanyl FAQ. So you'll be able to Google that on the California Bridge site if you feel like you don't know what you're doing. It'll be right there for you.
Okay. And is there anything like adverse reactions, anything like that I should be aware of when I'm trying this for the first time in the ER?
The buzzword that everyone would want me to throw out here is precipitated withdrawal. Like, what happens if they use methadone and didn't tell you or didn't know? Sometimes patients don't always know what's in their system, or are you going to make things worse? The vast majority of the time, the answer is no. And giving a little bit of buprenorphine and a patient not getting all the way better is not the same thing as precipitated withdrawal. That's just incomplete withdrawal. You're not done yet. Give more medicine, they'll get better. Precipitated withdrawal looks a lot more near and agitated delirium. People get very sick. They start vomiting instantly. They get really shaky. It's really different. So very different. In general, most people tolerate buprenorphine super well, especially the mono product, which is what we have in the hospital. Very low rates of GI upset, very low rates of allergic reaction. And since it's only a partial agonist, we just don't see respiratory depression and altered mental status, things you'd have to be worried about. It's extremely well-tolerated medication.
Let's talk about connecting patients to ongoing care. You talk about substance abuse navigators. What should people do if they don't have one of those available to them?
Not having a substance use navigator available is probably the more common scenario, right? Like most of us don't have that in our emergency department. If you have a social worker or you're lucky enough to have a case manager, that's also somebody who could do this. Or at a minimum, you just have to have a really good relationship with another clinic and somebody. It could be anybody. This could be a PA in your group that comes in the morning and does this. It could be a charge nurse. It could be anybody who comes in and reviews the list in the morning, and which isn't that many people. Think about a day in your ER, right? How many are we talking? Maybe two people a day, but makes a physical phone call to that clinic that the patient chooses or that you have the relationship with and says, hey, we saw this person yesterday. They want to come and see you. Here's their info. Can we get them an appointment? And then calls the patient and makes sure, hey, did you get your medicine? We got you this appointment. Here's how you get there. Having those resources available is super important. And it can be done by anybody, especially for smaller shops who are like, we're never going to have funding for a full-time substance use navigator. I get it. But if you're really that small of a place, you're not going to have that many patients that need it anyway. So it's not a huge ask to put on somebody more administrative on their plate.
Gotcha. And I work at a place where luckily we do have that available. Also in the community, I'm in Houston, we have what we call the Sobering Center. Colloquially, it's formerly the Houston Recovery Center. And it's a great place where we can send our patients for a multitude of different substance use issues so that they can work on getting into recovery. Okay, third thing you say, encourage a culture of harm reduction. So what does that look like for me, the ER doc, trying to counsel a patient about harm reduction at the bedside?
This echoes two separate things, really. One of them has to do with what you're asking, which is what can I do to do a good job with my patient? But the other actually has a lot more to do with hearkening back to how healthcare has had a relationship or a lack of relationship with patients who use drugs. I mean, we can all imagine those nights, right, where someone says, oh, the guy in bed 9 is a tweaker. Let's kick him to the curb, or this addict with the abscesses. Like, we don't generally talk very positively about these patients. We don't support them very well, and they know it. They hear us. They feel that. So a big part of this culture shift is actually believing and owning in your own heart. And there are full lectures out there. I would encourage somebody who's struggling with this to go find, even on the California Bridge website, full lectures about the neurocognitive stuff about addiction to understand that it is a chronic disease. People who have diabetes and eat a donut and then come in DKA, we don't talk about them really negatively and tell them we don't want to take care of them and the ER is not for them. The reason people make bad choices has to do with our reward center and all this other stuff. It's not because they're bad people. And so being able to say, hey, you have this chronic, you know, relapsing and remitting disease, and I'm really glad you came in, and can we talk about it? We have this treatment option. Do you want to quit? Because I know the withdrawals are really painful. I know they totally stink, and you don't want to go through that, and here's this medicine. Can I tell you about it? And then if they say, yes, you're connecting to care, there are a couple of other things. One is relapse is a part of this. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. I'm not encouraging you to relapse, but I want to make sure that if you're gonna, what to do and how to do that safely. Number one, never use alone. And there is a hotline actually that you can give to patients, a national hotline. You can just Google for it, never use alone hotline, and you can give them the phone number. They can call, it's anonymous. They give their location. They tell the person they're gonna use some drugs. They use the drugs. And the person like a few minutes later says, hey, are you there? And if the person's passed out, they send the ambulance to that location, or they say, yeah, I'm here. And they're like, okay, well, have a nice day. And they hang up the phone. So never using alone, preventing death from this. If you can arrange to do a take-home naloxone, I would absolutely send people home with naloxone, even if they're a stimulant user, because you never know these days with fentanyl what it could be in. But send everybody home with naloxone and then talking to them about safe injection. Ideally, they wouldn't inject in general because it opens a whole other bag of worms of problems, right? Hepatitis, HIV, abscesses, all of that, endocarditis. And so counseling them against the injection piece of it. But if they're going to, talk about alcohol swaps, talk about exchanging your needles and your syringes, not sharing with other people, and also referring them to your local public health office to screen for HIV, hep C, those kinds of things.
When preparing to talk to you, I was looking at some other studies. I was looking at a study out of Health Affairs talking about the X waiver, and they actually said that wasn't really the main barrier for a lot of people. A lot of the reason why we don't do this is because of training and mentorship. So at least if you go and you read the article in ASAP Now, that should give you some of the training. I guess in terms of mentorship, maybe we can all just email you. Every ER doctor will just contact you and you can be our mentor in making us take care of our patients better.
Well, what I'll throw out as a genuine offer is that if you do reach out to me, or if you would rather go to the California Bridge website, even though we're in California, we do have funding to be able to support hospitals. So if you're at a site and you think, if you want me or somebody else to come and talk to your group for 15 minutes and answer questions, we do that. We do it for free all the time. So in reality, maybe don't email me personally, but go to the California Bridge website, cabridge.org. Click the contact us button, put in that you're interested in just some advice and some help. And we honestly are super excited to do that. I think at the end of the day, the important thing for us to remember is that whatever your upbringing and your background and your experiences with people who use drugs, because a lot of us have negative stories affiliated, you know, with that experience. It's not good for you as a doctor to be angry at your patients all the time. And so it's awesome having legitimate, tangible, evidence-based tools to treat people that we historically never have been able to treat, and to take an approach that's truly compassionate and brings that human kindness. It will improve, I promise, it will improve your experience caring for those patients just as much as it actually benefits them and improves their health outcomes.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us on ASAP Nowcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to ASAP Nowcast for January. Thank you to our guests, Dr. Lally and Dr. Gonzalez, for joining us to talk about opioid use disorder. And just a tip about something that's going to be coming up in the February edition of the magazine. ASAP has sued the federal government over the No Surprises Act. So stay tuned to that. There are some wins that you will see what ASAP is doing for you in regards to surprise billing or balance billing. One thing that you may even see pretty soon is that patients' deductibles are going to be listed on their insurance cards. All right, until next time.
ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the hosts and any guests. The music is Florence Price's Fantasy No. 1 in G minor for violin and piano.